Glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. And joining me in the studio is Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, who is a professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Sandy, thanks so much for coming in.
It's nice to be here, Judith.
And we have lots of great things to talk about, and I think really timely things, too. One of the things that we wanted to touch on was doggy daycare and how to choose a good facility. A lot of people, you know, are working long hours, sometimes working more than one jobs, and families are busier than ever. And so often it's a good solution for our canine companions not to be alone all day, to be able to go and socialize and play and get some good care. Yeah. But just like choosing a daycare for your child, it can be pretty overwhelming.
It sure can. And, you know, my it's my ex-husband's dog. But anyways, he has been going to doggy daycare ever since he was little. And so he is 12 years old now. And he goes every Tuesday and Thursday. So he plays all weekend, is tired on Monday. Plays all Tuesday, tired on Wednesday, plays all Thursday, you know, so you get my drift,
right.
Okay?
It really is kind of like the schedules
great.
For kids.
It is. It's great exercise for them, but you really have to be careful with what you're looking for. First of all, you have to know your dog. I mean, my two dogs, I have two English Bulldogs. One play for them is laying on the couch, okay? So they don't want to be bugged.
They don't want to get rolled over by bigger dogs.
And so they are very happy staying home. And so you have to understand what your dog is like, and especially for older dogs, if they're arthritic and so on, they may not do well in an environment where there's a bunch of rowdy dogs. But some things that you really need to be looking for is, you know, does the facility that you want to go to actually put your dog through a behavior screening? You don't take it personally if your dog's declined, but if they're too fearful, you know, too rambunctious, too aggressive, whatever it may be, you know, they may be denied. So,
well, and to me, that would be a comfort because you know that the other dogs are being screened too.
Right. And then you also have to look at, you know, are they separated into different play groups? Because you can have big dogs and little dogs and you know, some that play really hard and some that don't. And so you want to make sure that they are dividing them up into groups and make sure that they're the right size of groups too. Probably, you know, if you've got like one person for 10 to 15 dogs, that's pushing it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ideally, you know, a play group shouldn't have any more than 6 to 10. Okay, so that would be ideal. But, you know, sometimes we have to stretch it a little bit in some situations. There has to be a human always there supervising. So what happens if somebody needs a potty break, human-wise? Okay, you know, dogs, well, they can go on the floor, I guess, but or go outside. But, you know, is there another human being there that's going to be watching? Because they need to have 100% human supervision all the time. Vaccination requirements, make sure that that's all taken care of, that your pet's up to date on vaccines, that everybody requires that. And that if there is any medical issues with any of the dogs, to give you an example, I just had a dog in yesterday that had a wart on its tongue, an oral papilloma, very common in dogs and quite contagious. It's like our warts, like planter's warts or whatever that we get, same type of virus that causes this. It's spread through saliva. This dog goes to doggy daycare. And I just said, nope, can't go until that wart is gone because he's going to be shedding that virus and spreading it to other dogs. And for most dogs, it's a minor problem. They get a little wart on their tongue. It's not a big deal. But we had a dog in a few months ago whose mouth and tongue and lips were just covered and the dog could barely eat. It had so many of them. So it can be serious. So something minor like that. So that dog's going to be out of daycare for the next few months. Owner's, her response was, well, I guess that means I get more exercise. Yay. You know, so she's going to be walking her dog. And that ideally we'd like to have somebody there that is a certified professional dog trainer, so they can understand dog body language and be, you know, on the lookout for perhaps when a trouble's going to happen so they can separate dogs, redirect them, do something like that, or get them into a different play group. And, you know, those are the big things that you want to be looking for.
And is there a good resource for checking about perhaps complaints, or is there any kind of certification?
Not that I know of, but I think it comes down to, you know, getting recommendations from people that go there. And, you know, asking what they do regarding if there is an emergency, will they take your dog to your clinic? How do they contact you? And I think some of the things that I personally would want, I mean, I've in the past boarded dogs, and this is getting into more dog boarding if you're going on vacation, but you should be able to either doggy daycare or boarding facility, stop in and visit anytime. And there are facilities where they're like, no, it gets the dogs upset. You can't go back there. And it's like, no, I don't want to have my dog left
that
here.
That would seem like a red flag.
Right. But there are many, even in Madison here, there are facilities that don't allow you to go back and see. So that would be on my list of avoiding those. And, you know, you just want to make sure that they're able to, you know, help your dog out. I have a diabetic dog that needs to get insulin while he's there. And that, not my own dog, but a client's dog. And he goes to doggy daycare 3 days a week, and they're able to give him his insulin as well. And they monitor his food, and they give him a special diet. And they need to be able to meet the needs of the pet and the client.
So like you said, a lot of it is knowing your dog and your dog's needs, mm-hmm. and then figuring out how they can best
right.
meet that.
Yeah, and it just comes down to visit, spend some time. And I love the places that have the camcorders up so that you can watch your dog log on anytime during the day and see what they're doing. And I remember one of our technicians one time the dog's laying on the sofa there. They had sofas spread around, and she's like screaming at the computer, "I pay this much a day, and all you do is sleep on the sofa. You know, get up and play." So she called the facility and said, "Would you please get him up and off the sofa so he could play?" So, yeah, and that's the kind of customer service you want.
That's great. Yep. And I want to make sure people know how to join in the conversation. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Erica Janik is our on-air producer today, waiting to answer your calls. And you can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org, and Erica will make sure we get those too. Sandy, since we were talking about doggy take care, it seems like a similar situation, but probably some different considerations to be aware of about boarding a pet during vacation or how to take care of a pet while you're gone. You know, not just dogs, obviously, cats.
Well, you have a cat, right?
I have a cat, Couscous.
Couscous.
And anyone who wants to see Couscous can go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. I put a picture up of her. She really is our little sweetie.
Yeah.
And so Couscous is part Blue Abyssinian. Abyssinians are very people oriented. She really notices when we're not there.
Right.
And, you know, in fact, when my husband leaves, she actually walks around talking for a while because mm-hmm. she's noticed mm-hmm. that he's gone. You know, so we try to have either someone stay or someone come in at
right.
least once a day and spend, you know, a good half hour with her playing. She's very playful
yep.
and interactive. Certainly not, you know, I've had cats where I wasn't sure they ever noticed whether I was there or not.
But I think putting a cat in a boarding kennel, it can be tough on them. But we do have in this area a absolutely amazing boarding kennel for cats. And I'm going to drop a name here, but it's called Catnip Hill. And it's over in the Deerfield area. And it's a little octagonal building. And the cats each have their own, you know, a big room with windows and, you know, different cat trees. And they've got bird feeders outside. And you know, they try to make it as stress-free as possible. But it really depends on the pet. So I just made arrangements this summer. I'm going out to Colorado for a week and renting a house and got special permission to be able to bring my dogs, even though the house doesn't allow pets, because they don't do well in a boarding facility. No one's there to, you know, make sure that they eat their food and clean their face folds and do things. So again, just like doggy daycare, know your pet, make sure that they've got, you know, good emergency care there. Is there somebody there 24 hours a day that can be monitoring and checking on pets? That would be ideal. Not all boarding facilities have anything like that. It really depends on the size.
Great. And we can certainly continue to talk about that, but I want to make sure that we get to some callers who are waiting to talk with you. Kathy in Brilliant has a question. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I just recently came across a stray cat, which we have officially adopted. We do have a vet appointment for it next week, but we've been dealing with some severe bouts of loose stool. And I did my research, and I've been feeding the cat boiled rice and chicken. I guess they call that the bland diet. And it's getting better, but I'm curious what you transition from that diet, because I don't know what the best cat food would be to go right to after that. So if you have
yeah.
any suggestions, that'd be great.
Good question. I mean, I'm glad you've got a veterinary appointment, because there's probably an underlying reason why your cat has diarrhea. It is not always a nutritional or diet-related issue. I mean, if you're feeding your cat milk, stop that. That can be one of the leading causes. But, you know, typically a normal cat's GI tract is going to be able to handle pretty much any cat food that you give them. But since he was a stray and you've picked him up, you know, we worry about things like parasitic diseases, lots of intestinal parasites that can cause chronic diarrhea. There are other health concerns that we get concerned about, in particular, the retroviruses, feline leukemia and FIV. That'll be something that the veterinarian will probably be drawing a blood sample for and testing. But bring in a fresh stool sample with you, as fresh as you can. If you can collect one, like hot off the press, and even if you put it in a baggie, and I know it sounds gross, but refrigerate it better to, you know, make sure that it stays fresh for the evaluation if you've got like an appointment later on in the afternoon. It never fails that, you know, when we need a stool sample, you know, we don't have one. So get it when you can. And when it comes to changing cats, you know, anytime we've got a cat that's been on a, or a dog on a long-term diet, make sure that you transition to whatever new diet you're using slowly so you can make sure that the cat's GI tract isn't suddenly stressed by having more fats or protein or carbohydrates or fiber or whatever may be in it. Your cat is on a very low fiber diet right now. And so if you were to just cold turkey that and go to regular food, that could upset the GI tract. So I'm usually looking over a few days, 3, 4, 5 days of slowly transitioning, you know, the proportions up to the new food. And I'm not going to say which food to feed your cat because I think there's probably an underlying medical reason. You address that, the cat should be able to be on regular cat food.
Great. Thanks for that call, Kathy. And let's go to Amy in Milwaukee. Hi, Amy.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 17-week-old English bulldog, and I am... He has already started humping, and so I definitely want to get him fixed right when he turns 6 months. But I've been doing some research on nuticles.
Mm-hmm.
The vet's opinion on, is it purely just cosmetic or psychologically could it be beneficial?
I'm sorry. I've almost got tears coming down my face. So first of all, congratulations on getting a little bulldog puppy. They're cute as a button at that age, and good for you for considering, you know, having him neutered rather than keeping him intact. But remember, the behavior that you're noting, the humping behavior, may not all be sexual. It can be control, it could be play, and it may persist even after he is neutered. So don't think that that is going to be stopping it 100%. So if you see him starting to do it, redirect him to something else. I have a female bulldog that if I sit in a certain chair with my legs crossed a certain way, she'll come and hump my foot, and I have to throw a toy or do something to redirect her and get her onto something else. But your question regarding nuticles, these are silicone artificial testicles that can be implanted in dogs. They are definitely for the human and not for the dog. You can get them in the regular form. They come in all different sizes, from a cat, yes, believe it or not, cat testicle size, all the way up to horses. And so they have very large, and they have them, some of them are lifelike feeling. Some of them actually have an epididymis on them. I suggest you go to the website and look at what the cost of them are to begin with. They can be a little pricey. And remember, it is just for you so that you can feel that your neutered dog looks like a tough, intact male. Again, you're putting foreign material into the dog. Yes, it's not, you know, it's probably not reactive. It's medical grade silicone, but absolutely not necessary. But while you're there, they also sell keychains and t-shirts and hats and aprons and all kinds of stuff that would probably make fun retirement gifts for people if you're... You really want to, you know, have a laugh. So, yep.
Wow. Well, I can certainly go home today and say I learned something new because I did not know about
yes.
that.
Yes. All right.
Thanks for that call, Amy. And let's go on to Connie in Portage. Hi, Connie.
Oh, hello. I have a six-month-old corgi puppy. And about 3 weeks ago, all of a sudden, he doesn't want to eat. And he'll eat if I put, like, little pieces of meat on top of his food. Or something like that, a table food of some kind. But I thought I shouldn't keep that up. So I set his food down, and then I tried three different type brands, and he's still doing that. So I was wondering what your suggestion might be.
How many days has he gone without eating?
Oh, he's never gone any because I give in.
So he's got you so well trained. Well, first of all, you know, anytime you've got a pet that has an appetite change, that may be a signal that there's a medical issue. So if there's any concerns about his activity level or, you know, anything, you need to take him in to have your veterinarian evaluate him. But it sounds like he has got you, if he's healthy, very well trained. And I would, you know, not make a big deal about feeding. I think sometimes we end up creating eating disorders in dogs because we are so anxious about eating. We stand over them and like, eat, eat, you don't love me if you don't eat. And, you know, and then we start throwing food at them and he's getting, you know, getting some really good tasty stuff. It would be no different than a kid's, you know, having their plate of healthy food on the table and, you know, and yet, you know, you putting ice cream next to them and saying, well, you know, since you're not eating, here's something really good. And what are they going to do? They're going to go to the good stuff. So I would just, at this point, if he's healthy, ride it out. Put the food down, he will eat, okay? And you know, unless he's got like mouth pain or something to cause some trouble, what you may want to add to his food that may spice it up a little bit but is not going to throw off the balance of his diet is the Iams Company, and I believe there's several other companies, make bottles of like dog gravy that are not really high in salt or anything. It's not like our gravy, real high fat. They're relatively low in calories, but they're quite flavorful. And you can, you know, just drizzle a little bit of that over the food and that may perk up his appetite as well. And then you can transition away from that or stay with it because it's a, would be a safe thing to add in.
Great. Thanks for that call, Connie. And we are talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine today. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. If you have any questions about pet care, we'd be happy to hear from you. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, and we'll be right back here on the Ideas Network. We're talking pet care with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. And Sandy, we had a question on the Facebook page. That's the Larry Mueller Show. You can go to that. Jim had a question going back to the issue of pets being left by themselves. He says, why does my cat drag socks to her food and water dish when we are away for a couple days, even if someone stops in to check on her? She doesn't do this when we're around.
Isn't that a weird behavior? And you know what? I'm always surprised by the weird things our pets will do. My guess is that the cat probably has a little bit of separation anxiety, and cats can have separation anxiety just like dogs can, where they don't like being left alone. Some of them can be extremely stressed, and I've seen some cats do things like urinate on the owner's bed, pull their fur out and actually over-groom themselves because they're so stressed. But this, I mean, I think it's probably like a kind of like a hunting behavior, just dragging the prey back to the bowl, and maybe the cat's just bored and it's something to do. But I would expect they would do that when you're at home too. But yeah, isn't that?
But probably it has something. Yeah. I mean, it's obviously it has the scent of the owner.
Yeah.
And
yeah, and he, you know, the cat wants to have something for the owner to chuckle about when they get home. I don't know. I have no idea, but it's cool. And you know,
The separation anxiety thing is real because I had a cat who had never had any behavioral or health problems. I was going away to study abroad for a year and asked a friend if he could keep my cat for a year. Said, oh, no problems ever. Well, poor Bigwig, who is a very sweet cat and very attached to me, got very anxious that I was gone and basically groomed his head bald.
Oh, my goodness.
And so my poor friend, who was taking care of the low-maintenance cat, suddenly had a high-maintenance, anxious cat to take care of.
Most cats that have, barbering their hair coat because they're anxious are going to do their belly and maybe their legs. Head area?
He scratched himself.
Yeah, I start worrying more about allergic disease or something like that. So,
And Days in Madison has a question. Hi, Days.
Good morning. Okay, I got a puppy out of a no-kill shelter. And the shelter basically paid for all these quote-unquote shots that it was in the adoption fee. And, you know, all these shots, I'm really not quite sure what they're for. So, but basically, right, we're at the end of that. Now there's places they're sending us to, which is their vets, because I don't even live close. I'm going to be getting my own vet because it's closer to my house. But it's a Bordetella shot.
Mm-hmm.
Now the dog does not really associate with many others, except maybe when you're walking or anything. Is that an essential shot? And I have one last question.
Okay. Well, this is something that we do routinely for dogs. When you look at vaccines, there's actually, I'm going to recommend a website that people to go to. The American Animal Hospital Association has published on there vaccine guidelines for dogs, and excellent source to look at for not only veterinarians, but for owners as well, as to kind of what's essential, what's recommended. And we divide vaccines up into core vaccines, vaccines that every dog needs regardless of lifestyle, and non-core vaccines, which would be the ones that really are lifestyle dependent. So to give you an example, you know, if I put my hand, I said, you know, for the three of us in the room here, or anybody listening, let's have a show of hands, who gets tetanus? And everybody puts their hand up because that's considered a core vaccine for people. Everybody needs tetanus vaccine. But if I said for in the human world, how many of us need rabies? I bet I'm the only one in the room here that's been vaccinated for rabies because I get exposed. So that would be a non-core vaccine for me. So for your dog, the core vaccines, rabies vaccination, definitely, distemper, parvovirus, and another one called adenovirus 2. Those are the only core vaccines. Everything else is optional. But I look at kennel cough vaccine or Bordetella, which is very similar to our pertussis. We get Bordetella pertussis. Dogs get Bordetella bronchoseptica. And so it's kind of like our whooping cough. Look who gets vaccinated for whooping cough. Young kids. And it's because if they get exposed, they are going to be more at risk of developing serious complications. Same is true for puppies. And I look at every puppy that should be given, even though it's not a core vaccine, I think for their age, it needs to be given. Later on in life, you can look at what their lifestyle is going to be like. If they're going to be boarding, going to doggy daycare, going to dog parks, lots of dog interaction. Or if you have a dog that is conformationally like mine, with the flat face, have difficulty breathing, the last thing we would want is a respiratory infection in one of those dogs, like my bulldog. So if you've got like a pug-like dog, probably continue to vaccinate. And one thing that we sometimes forget too is Bordetella can be, a dog kennel cough can be transmitted to immunocompromised people. And so if you're living in a home with someone that's on chemotherapy or an AIDS patient, they need to continue, you need to be vaccinating your dog regardless of what their lifestyle is like. So, yeah.
And Sandy, what about dogs that go to a dog park? You know, they might not be boarding with other dogs, but if they're interacting, is that an indication?
It's probably, again, that environment's relatively low risk because you're outside and you're not breathing the same air. But if they're like nose to nose with another dog, yes, you could potentially get it. So I think even dog park dogs should be vaccinated for it.
Great. And Daisy, you had another question?
Yeah, great advice. Thank you. Basically, and now the dog basically kind of does a little hippity hop once, just a rarity once in a while. The back rear, mm-hmm. the back left leg does like a little skip. I see these all a lot of times in Chihuahuas.
Yeah.
Now my dog's about maybe 35 pounds.
Yep.
Kind of a shepherd husky mix, I think. But anyway, the vet said it was a congenital patellar luxation.
Oh, that's exactly the words that were going to come out of my mouth. And what that is the kneecap, which if you feel your own knee, it sits in a groove. And as you bend and flex your leg, that your kneecap should stay in that groove and not slide side to side. And some dogs are blessed with a very narrow groove, and they're just the way they're built. That kneecap is sloppy and it can slide side to side. So my guess is your dog just puts their foot down in the right position and that kneecap pops out. They have to do a little, as you said, hippity hop, and the kneecap pops back in and they're off and running again. This can lead to long-term arthritis and issues that way. So if it's becoming more of a problem for your dog, surgical repair may be in order, but you may want to talk to your veterinarian about joint supplements to help keep that joint as healthy as you can, and make sure your dog does not gain a lot of weight, because that's going to put a lot of stress on that joint as well.
Great. Thanks for that call, Dave. And kudos to you for adopting a shelter dog, a rescue dog, too. Jody in Superior is next. Hi, Jody.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We just recently adopted a, she's 9-pound Chihuahua long-haired dachshund mix. And we brought her into the vet for her checkup and her rabies shot. And the veterinarian said that she has a baby tooth that did not fall out,
mm-hmm.
and that she thought it needed to be removed surgically. And I'm just wondering what the consequences are if that tooth is not removed.
Yeah, this happens especially in small breed dogs where you've got lots of crowding in the mouth. And if the tooth bud for the permanent tooth is like offset from where the baby tooth is, what causes the baby tooth to fall out is that permanent tooth kind of pushing down on it, and it, you know, it just replaces the baby tooth. Baby tooth falls out of the mouth and the permanent tooth replaces it. But if the tooth bud is offset a little bit, the two teeth will be there side by side. What that does is it, again, is going to add more crowding to the mouth. You've got a tooth in a place that it doesn't belong. And dogs typically have, a self-cleaning type mouth where they don't need to floss like we do. They can still get tartar and stuff on the outside of their teeth. But for the most part, a normal mouth, you shouldn't get any like food particles or anything stuck between the teeth because the way they're positioned. But if you've got a retained tooth, that's going to happen. I just had a dog in the other day that saw as a puppy that it had retained four retained canine teeth, baby teeth, and it came in a year later, and now we're wondering if the dog is going to even have its permanent teeth in its mouth. They've got that much periodontal disease from the, you know, having those teeth crowded there. So the dog needs to now have some major oral surgery done to try to correct the mess that's there. Better to get it taken care of when they're young before disease takes place, and it can happen quickly within a year.
Thanks for that call. And speaking of teeth and chewing, Sandy, there is a recall for some pig ears as dog chews because of a salmonella risk.
Well, you know, and yeah, it is. There is one out, and it's a company, an Illinois company, and it's called Pig Ears for Pet Treats. And, you know, it's like I just read this and I went, well, it's a no-brainer. Anything you feed the animal that is from the animal, like, you know, raw hides, pig ears, or whatever's on the outside, you may be bringing home. So, you know, this is just a danger of using body part chew things for your dogs. And if you've got young children, someone who's immunocompromised, I would not be having these kind of treats in the house, period. I mean, and the same thing is true for like things like raw diets, salmonella is out there and you just have to be aware of it. So if you are using those kind of things, make sure that you're washing your hands after handling them. I don't even like picking them up in the pet store. I'll put my hand in a baggie and grab them that way so I'm not having to touch them.
So does the salmonella affect the animals as well, or is it more a risk for the people?
More risk for the people. Hmm. A lot of dogs and cats can be asymptomatic, but shedding it in their fecal material. And so then we are at risk of having it on the treat, in their mouth, in their stool. It's everywhere. And, you know, salmonella has even been an issue with the little pet frogs that are out there, too. I have one. It's in my daughter's room in an aquarium. And it's one of these things where when she was little, went to a pet store and they have this, it's called Love a Frog or Grow a Frog, and you get sent a tadpole, and it's a lifetime guarantee. If your frog passes away, you send in this coupon and you send you another one.
Oh, it's
and
your lifetime guarantee.
Yeah, it's eight. Yeah, it's eight. You know, so 18 years now we've had frogs at home, and so this one's called Claudus, and we have to, you know, that's there again because they are a reptilian type animal. They carry salmonella normally, and so as I'm like cleaning the filter and the gravel, I'm thinking, you know, this is gross. If I did this in my kitchen sink, I could potentially contaminate my kitchen. So again, if you've got these little frogs, they may not be harmless. Kids shouldn't be cleaning the tank. Have parents take care of them.
Are turtles also a salmonella risk?
And turtles are. I have one at home named Vern, big tortoise, and we, you know, have the disinfectant hand gel right there and are always washing our hands after handling them. And, you know, so far, knock on wood, I've stayed healthy, but there's always that risk.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is our guest today on the Ideas Network. She's a professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. And you can join in with your question or comment by calling 1-800-642-1234 or emailing us at talk@wpr.org. And Lee from Cudahy would like to join in. Hi, Lee.
I have a question. I have a Westie, and he's about 11 years old, and he was diagnosed with infected anal glands, and the doctor prescribed Dermalone ointment. I'm supposed to keep the area clean and shaved and put it on every twice a day for 7 to 10 days, and I'm supposed to have them expressed or squeezed every 6 to 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
He said if I don't want to bring them in, I could do it. Is that something that a person can do?
Yeah, but yes, it's not something, I mean, even as a veterinarian, I don't prefer to do it. So when I can pawn it off on a vet student, it's a wonderful thing. But remember, anal glands are a normal part of the dog anatomy, and the ducts point inward towards the rectum. And so the safest way, especially in a dog that may have some scarring or thick anal gland discharge, always a lunchtime talk. It never fails. We get this topic, but it's better to do a rectal. And so when I'm training owners how to express anal glands at home, I actually hold up my hand, and I'm doing it here, and I draw little anal glands on the side of my hand, like, you know, with a pen. And I say, now put your finger in the hole here, which is my hand made into a fist, and have them practice squeezing on my hand. Then they try it on their dog. And it's not a pleasant thing to do, but
for you or the dog.
For me or the dog. But I have to tell this funny story. I had, I have been now long-term dating this wonderful gentleman named Mark, but we met on online dating, and I met him at a local restaurant, and I had left work and ran in, and of course, I did not wash my hands before I left, and I had little anal glands drawn on my hand, and I went to shake hands with him, and he's like, what's that on your hand? And this is like the first 30 seconds we've met, and I'm like, oh, those are anal glands. This is a dog's rectum, you know? Well, I must have, you know, just, we hit it off, and we've been together ever since. So,
well, yeah. And that was a good sign that he stayed for lunch.
Yes.
Great. Thanks for that, Collie. And Tom and Earl, let's go to you. Hi, Tom.
Great. Thanks for that, Collie. And
oh, hello.
Oh. Hi, Tom.
Anyway, I got a 3-year-old.
Tom, can you turn your radio down, please?
Oh, I'm sitting outside my truck here. I'll turn it down here.
Yeah, thanks.
Tom, can you turn your radio down, please?
All right.
There you go.
All right. Tom, what's your question?
Okay, I got a 3-year-old St. Bernard, female St. Bernard. I got 3 questions, actually. When is the best time to breed her? What is the age of stop breeding her at? And what about mammalian cancer?
Oh, well, very good questions.
I'll take my answers off there.
Okay. Well, smart of you to be thinking about all these things before you go ahead and do it. St. Bernards are a dog that are prone to lots of different health issues, but primarily orthopedic problems. So before you breed your dog, she's old enough now that you could have her hips checked, her elbows checked, her eyes checked for congenital problems, making sure that that she's as healthy as she can be before she's used for reproducing. Don't just look at her and say, well, she doesn't limp, she can't have bad hips. They need to be x-rayed, and they have to be sent in to a certification organization. There's 2 available. One is called the Orthopedic Foundation for Animals, or OFA. The other is called PenHip, where they get evaluated. And so make sure you have that done. Then you also want to be looking at, you know, is she the right temperament, and does she, you know, meet the norm of the breed? There are many wonderful dogs out there that maybe look like a St. Bernard, but probably are not show quality and shouldn't be used for reproducing because, you know, they've got a too small of a head, or they're too big, or they're too small, or whatever. So get an opinion from somebody that is a professional dog breeder, that knows the breed, that shows the breed, to be able to find out. And best way that you can prove that is put her in a dog show yourself, and actually win. And that's going to, you know, show everybody that, yes, you've got a dog that's worthy of this. I'm going to get on my soapbox here a little bit too, but I look at the only guarantee, if you have a litter of puppies and you go to sell them, you probably won't make a lot of money selling puppies. I can tell you that. Guaranteed, you're going to need a C-section or health issues and, you know, vet checks and all these things. Really eats up any profits you're going to make pretty quickly. So don't do it for the money. You're doing it to better the breed. But the guarantee that I would give if I was a breeder to anybody that gets one of my dogs, if I were to breed a dog, would be lifetime. What I mean by that is that if you were to take your dog, if you were to adopt a dog out, and 5 years from now that family can't keep that dog, you don't want to put a burden on society by having that dog now have to go to rescue groups or to a shelter. You will take it back and find a home for it. So look at that when you start breeding your dogs. Are you willing to do that? Are you in a situation where you would take those puppies back, or adult dogs back? So best time to breed your dog after all those criteria are met. Okay, so that's what it comes down to. You also have to be looking at health risks for your dog. You may be shortening her life expectancy. Dogs that are intact and she's already past the point of no return have a very dramatic increased risk of developing breast cancer. And so I teach owners how to do monthly breast exams on their dogs. Takes a little bit because there's lots there. There's usually 10 that you have to palpate, but it's worth it. Find something early so that it can be taken care of early. It's a sad thing when we make that diagnosis in a dog. So you may be shortening your life expectancy by allowing that, you know, allowing her to stay intact. So, but again, spaying her now is not going to reverse what's already happened. And when to stop? You know, St. Bernards are pretty much senior citizens when they get to be 6 or 7 years of age. And so I would not be breeding her past probably 5 or 6, and I'd be stopping at that point. But you have to look at what her genes are like and how long her parents lived, and that may give you a little more hints as to how long she can be a breeding dog.
Thanks for that call, and let's move on to Connor in Appleton. Hi, Connor.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got a 15-year-old Springer Spaniel who we are pretty sure is very close to the end of her life. She's had lots of health problems, really high liver enzymes for a long time, and she's been treated for a lot of different stuff, and she's doing okay aside from being old. But she hasn't really recovered from, and I can't think of the full term, but it's something about a vestibular infection. I apologize, I can't think of the full term for it.
It's called old dog vestibular disease or idiopathic vestibular disease, where very common in old dogs, where they all of a sudden they acutely have loss of balance and their head's tilted. They may be rolling. They sometimes vomit, like they're on a tilt-a-whirl. Most dogs within a few days to a couple of weeks may get over it. There may be some residual changes as well.
Yeah. And it's been a few weeks now, and she just really hasn't recovered fully. She's better than she was, but she's been mostly deaf for a long time now. Anyway, her body's just getting really old, and we know it's her time really soon. I'm wondering if there are any clues that we can glean from her as to if she's in pain or if she, you know, when, in other words, if she can help us know when it's time better than we can know. Because we know, all we know right now is that it's soon.
Yeah.
She still goes nuts about treats.
Good.
Even though she, like you said, she still goes out on the tilt-a-whirl in the yard, and if we take her on a hike or something, she still enjoys doing that. The spirit is willing, but the body is just less able, and we just don't want to end up being cruel and selfish.
Yeah. Well, I've said this before in the air, that kind of the motto that I live by, and I'm not saying that this is at the her time at this point right now, but I would rather end a dog's life or a cat's life or, you know, guinea pig's life or whatever a week too early than let them suffer one day too long. But the dilemma is, when is the time? And you know, you will know. I mean, it comes down to sometimes it's the look that they give you. Maybe it's going to be the day that she doesn't want to go for a walk or that she is not taking her favorite treat. But if you were to just, like, you know, wait, I mean, some dogs will eat right to the very end. And so you can't just use appetite as a gauge. If, you know, but you have to look at other things. Is she able to get up on her own? If she can, great. If she can't and needs assistance, are you able to be there to be able to get her outside so that she's not eliminating on herself and having some, you know, issues that way? Does she still enjoy life? It sounds like she does. And so, you know, that's something that, you know, you need to take account, make sure that you are watching that when she just starts not enjoying life, to make that decision too. Is she socially interactive or does she isolate herself? Sometimes that's the only sign of pain that you may see, is that they just don't want to be touched. They, like, you know, lay down in one area and, you know, don't want to be petted anymore. So, you know, be on the lookout for that. Pain is one of those things where I wish dogs could verbalize, and sometimes they do. You know, you get some wimpy dogs that'll cry or make sounds, but usually it's just us watching them trying to get up and limping, or, you know, it's sometimes they're very vague symptoms. So, yeah, it's looking at the whole big package and making your decision that way. And this is the toughest time. This is like the pre-grieving decision making. I've been in this situation with dogs before. I had an old basset hound, and I remember every morning walking downstairs and saying, you know, you're still enjoying life, but please be dead, because I don't want to have to make that decision. And she'd wag her tail and be awake. And then finally, it was just one day that I just realized that, you know, she wasn't happy anymore. And it's when she couldn't get up on her own to be able to go outside. And that's what did it. She couldn't rise on her own.
Thanks for that call, Connor, and certainly good luck with that decision and that transition in your family. We're talking with Sandy Sawchuk today, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. If you have a question or a comment, feel free to give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, today sitting in for Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today and talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. If you have questions about your pets, you can certainly join our conversation. And we have Jen in Milwaukee who wants to do just that. Hi, Jen.
Hi. I have this wonderful rescue dog who happens to be 3 years old this week, and he weighs 55 pounds. Now, what my problem is, I don't know what dose I should get of things like Frontline or Advantix because he's right on the cusp between two dose sizes.
Yeah, well, Frontline, I think they're 44 to 88 pounds, so he's not right on the cusp. So you could use something like that. The best advice I could give you is talk to your veterinarian. They would be able to know, what would work out best for your dog. But I think that, you know, if Advantix is, you know, your dog is, like you said, right on the cusp, maybe go to Frontline because that covers the 44 to 88 pound size and your dog's kind of right in the middle of that. So that may be the safest thing to use. But that is a problem for veterinarians and owners when you've got a dog that, you know, maybe weighs 25 pounds and you're looking at all the heartworm preventatives treating 25 and, you know, and up to 25 and then 26 and maybe the weight fluctuates a little bit. There are some products that it's better to err on the side of going a little bit higher. There's some that I would say probably err on the side of being a little on the lower dose, such as some of the topical flea and tick preventatives. But I think with your dog at 55, you know, the heartworm preventative is 51 to 100, so you're fine on that. And I would, you know, go with the higher dose of heartworm preventative and, you know, probably Frontline would be the best bet for you.
Great. Thanks for that call. And actually, while we're talking about medication, Sandy, you know, like human medications, pet meds can get pretty expensive, especially if it's something that's treating a chronic condition that might go on for years. I know that it's possible to buy meds online and that it can seem like a big savings. What are the things that people should be taking into account if they're thinking of doing that?
Well, first of all, check with your veterinarian. It may be that their price is better. And just because it says in the commercial, you know, don't waste your time going to your vet, which, you know, they do. And you know, we have it delivered right to your door. Your veterinarian may actually, it might be cheaper. And there are some services now where even the vet clinic can have it shipped to your house. And so they work with like group pharmacies and so on. But if you do want to go online, make sure that you are using a service that does require a prescription from your veterinarian. There are overseas pharmacies that will say, that you don't need a prescription, that, you know, we'll just fill it for you. Or even in this country, there are pharmacies that say, well, we have a veterinarian on staff that will review what you need. And a patient-doctor relationship does not consist of having a veterinarian in another state that doesn't know your dog. So you really need to be working, you know, with your veterinarian on this. But one thing to be looking at, too, to make sure that you're getting high-quality drugs, that you're working with a recognized veterinary pharmacy, is there's a little oval logo that should be on their website, and it says VetVips, V-I-P-P-S, and it stands for Veterinary Verified Internet Pharmacy Practice Site. So you want to be looking for a site that has that on it. And if that's there, then you can be pretty well sure that they're well regulated, that you're getting the medication that's in the package, and that they will be working with your veterinarian. I had somebody yesterday, that I got a fax that they wanted a prescription filled from one of our state's local pharmacies, and I had to deny it because I've not seen the patient for over a year, and so I don't have a valid patient-doctor relationship. That's the pharmacy that I appreciate and will recommend to somebody else because they allow me to do that. They're just not filling a prescription without making sure it's okay with me.
Carrie in Lisbon wants to join in. Hi, Carrie.
Oh, hello. My daughter recently adopted a 2-year-old dog. In fact, she's had the dog for 2 weeks, and the dog cries every time she leaves the dog to the point where she is now taking the dog to the office with her. Now, I'm wondering, when a dog is 2 years old, is it possible to get the dog out of that kind of behavior, or what do you suggest for something like that?
Well, the fact that this is a rescue dog and that the dog cries when it's left alone, we've mentioned this earlier in the show. I believe the dog probably has separation anxiety. It would take a good interview to sit down and find out just what the dog's doing. It may be that the dog is sitting at the window and is just, you know, crying and barking at squirrels and mailman and so on, and it's just kind of, you know, bored and keeping busy that way. But a very common problem in rescue dogs is that when they're left alone, they think they're abandoned again. This is a treatable condition. It requires not only behavioral modification and working that way with a veterinarian who's well-versed in behavior or an applied animal behaviorist, but also sometimes medical management is necessary to get this problem under control. I'm glad that she can take her dog to work with her, because the kind of the rule when we're starting to deal with this condition is to never leave the dog alone for longer than it can cope with. And so right now, that means that she either needs to have a pet sitter or take the dog with her, take it to doggy daycare, as we mentioned earlier, or something like that. But it needs to be worked on. If you don't, it's going to get worse. I mean, I've had dogs break teeth, rip claws out, tear the house apart, get through doors, jump through windows. It's amazing the damage that they can do to themselves just because they are so panicked being left alone. So get working on it right away.
And thanks for that call. Carrie, we had an email from Emily. She has a boxer who loves going for long walks. During the winter, she lets her eat snow when she needs a drink. Now that it's warm, her boxer wants to drink from puddles and ditches, and Emily wants to know if that's okay. She lives in a rural area, and she's worried it might make her dog sick.
Yes, I would carry water with you. In fact, I'm just set up my garage. I'm having a big garage sale this weekend, and I have a portable water dish that has a lid on it, and it just has a little strap, and you can put it around. They even make some that are useful for people, a water bottle, and then it's got a little flip-down thing that, you know, you can squirt it in for your dog. But yes, carry water with you if your dog's thirsty. The big issue with drinking from puddles is things like Giardia, which is a parasite that likes to live in wet areas, Cryptosporidium, you know, E. coli, lots of things. And now that it's warmer out, things like algae blooms, and we do see blue-green algae toxicity in this area too, so avoid those areas.
Well, and what about mosquito larvae? Are those a danger too?
That's
not really?
No, I mean, just a little extra protein, but yeah, that's not
kind of gross, but not gonna
hurt. Yeah, but you know, sometimes ditches and stuff have been treated, yeah. The pesticides are running down
that's
in there
point.
And it's just, you need to just you know, if you wouldn't drink it, don't let your dog drink it.
And then actually an email from Jim. It's kind of a good follow-up to that. Jim wrote, I was surprised to hear you recommend against garlic in dogs a couple shows ago. I had read that the other allium, onions, is hard on dogs because they have thiosulfate, but garlic has negligible amounts of it and was pronounced safe and a good parasite preventive.
Well, one, it doesn't prevent parasites, period, end of story. You'll read that online, but none of the research confirms that. And people have used garlic for like flea control and things like that, and it does not work. And yeah, it doesn't contain much of the toxic chemical, but if your dog gets into enough of it, and it really depends, look at how many different sizes of dogs we have. So if you give, you know, a Great Dane dose to a Chihuahua, you could be in trouble. So just a good thing to avoid. Other things, you know, that I would be avoiding in dogs, no avocado. No macadamia nuts, lots of things like that. So again, you know, you got to know if you're bringing a species into your house, you got to know what you can safely have around.
Let's go to Mary in Madison next. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, hi, it's me.
Yes.
I'm calling about a corn snake. We have a corn snake that's about 2 years old. It's my children's pet. We all, you know, take care of it. And it molted about 2 weeks ago. And before the molt, he didn't eat, which is pretty typical for him. We didn't realize he was about to molt. Then he molted. But typically after he molts, he is very happy to eat again.
Mm-hmm.
And he has not eaten now, and I think it's going on 3 weeks.
Okay.
And we were kind of wondering if this is a sign that something else could be going on.
Yeah.
He's drinking a lot. He drinks normal, his amount. We keep offering him little mice that we defrost and then offer it to him, and he just looks at it now.
Yeah.
Like it's...
And, it, you know, probably the number one reason for when we have reptiles that have eating disorders or health problems, it's because of management and housing and how they're, just, whether it's temperature, humidity, nutritional basis or whatever. And so I think the first thing I would do is, talk to either your veterinarian or a veterinarian that, find one that works with reptiles. We have an excellent special species service at the veterinary school here in Madison. And when you look at the intake sheet, a history sheet compared to, a dog and cat history sheet, almost everything on a special species intake sheet is about housing, food, humidity, temperatures, where they're housed, and so on, because that's what leads to so many medical problems. So I think I would be looking at that first before, and that might need the help of someone who specializes in snakes. So get them in, have them evaluated.
All right. Thanks so much for that call. And we had an email asking, why do animals need to get vaccines every year or two when humans tend to only need one?
That's a question that we have addressed in the veterinary world. And I brought up that website earlier, the American Animal Hospital Association, the canine vaccine guidelines. And then for cats, it's the American Association of Feline Practitioners. They have their guidelines on there. The new guidelines, actually, they're not that new. It's been out for now for many, many years, is that we limit the number of vaccines that we give especially for the viral components, to doing them every 3 years. And there's even a push now to start lengthening that length of the time between vaccines. There's an independent study going on looking at rabies to see if we can lengthen the time between rabies vaccines to maybe every 5 years or 6 years. Right now, the law is to do it every 3 years. We're also doing that with the distemper and parvo vaccines, doing it on an every 3 year basis. But I even have some people that want to do titers, which is a measure of the immune response, in lieu of vaccinating to see if they're still protected. To give you an example, I was last rabies vaccinated in 1983, and I ended up in the hospital with a pretty severe allergic reaction. And so now every year or two, I just get my blood checked to make sure that I'm still protected. And here it is, how many years later? Very protected. So don't have to do it every year.
Thanks for that call. And thank you. We are going to be going into the news, but if you have a question, please call us at 1-800-642-1234, and we'll be back shortly. Glad to have you along today on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. And Sandy, we had a question emailed to us about that it seems like a lot of dogs are being put down due to various kinds of cancer. And you actually had information about a very large study that came out of the University of Georgia looking at the causes of death among different dog breeds. What were the most interesting findings on that?
Well, just the question regarding cancer, about 50% of dogs and 30 to 35% of cats are going to have a tumor at some point in their life. I mean, it just comes down to the fact that they're living longer. And when we started looking at this longevity study, they looked at 75,000 different dogs and the cause of death. And this was like looking at records over from 1984 to 2004. Definitely a higher rate of cancer in certain breeds of dogs. Number one was the Bernese Mountain Dog. Number two was the Golden Retriever. And, people will get Goldens and say, well, why do all Goldens die of cancer? It comes down to they've been blessed with the genes to develop this. And I'll have people say, well, isn't it something in the environment? It must be the food. It must be the vaccines you're giving. It has to be something that's causing this. But, cancer just occurs because of, at least for animals, between looking at genetic risk and age. And pets are living longer than ever. If you don't die from infectious diseases or trauma, probably if you're especially one of those top breeds, cancer is going to get you. I think that we tend to blame so many other things, but sometimes it's the breeds that we're showing that we're interested in adopting that are reaching popularity. But some of the big things that the study came out with, which is going to help veterinarians, is looking at things that you need to be screening for probably more often. the, you know, cancer, which you just talked about, all these dogs that are in the top, you know, group of dogs that get cancer are all large breed dogs. And so, you know, looking for lumps and bumps and changes that could be indicative of having some type of cancer, that, for small dogs, we tend to see more neurologic problems and endocrine problems, heart disease. And so monitoring for Cushing's disease or diabetes and things like that in small dogs, paying attention to that stuff. But, and, you know, for large dogs, the bigger the dog, more chance of musculoskeletal problems or gastrointestinal problems. So, you know, if you pick a dog, you've got to, you know, recognize that, you know, they all have their own individual things. And I don't think it's an increase in cancer. I think it's an increase awareness and people are seeking treatment and just a good, you know, sign that we are having our pets live longer through, you know, all the stuff that we're doing to keep them healthier.
We have some folks that have been waiting for a while, so let's go to the phones. Jennifer in Janesville. Hi. Jennifer? Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I've got a cat, George, who I've had for about 3 years. And for about 2 years now, he's been getting these little lumps, mainly around his neck or down by his paws. And every time I take him to the vet, they say that it's some sort of an allergic reaction. So he's now on food that has no grain, no, you know, it's the best food that I can get him. And this last time, he was on steroids and antibiotics for about 3.5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Within a week after getting off the steroids, he developed another lump.
Okay.
So I'm wondering, what else can I do? I feel bad having him on steroids. And in the past year, he's gained almost 8 pounds.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, when we have allergies in pets, it's not always food. There's other things that they can become allergic to. And unless you're getting your food from your veterinarian, it's very hard to find a hypoallergenic diet at a pet store or grocery store. When we're looking at feeding a diet that is going to, you know, help the cat, if they have been truly diagnosed with food allergies, we would be looking at a novel protein and carbohydrate source, or what's called a hydrolyzed protein diet, where they take a protein, usually it's from chicken, and they break it down into little bits that the body is not going to recognize the species that it's from. So we have many cats that are on like rabbit and green pea, venison and quinoa. You know, there's all kinds of weird diets out there that they are balanced commercial diets that you can get, but they're therapeutic diets that you would have to get through your veterinarian. When we have a pet with food allergies, it's important that they get that diet and nothing else. So no little treats, no table food, no milk, nothing. They just get that diet and nothing else. And that usually will keep an animal that's purely food allergic under control. But there are other things that pets can become allergic to in the environment. Sometimes it's things like flea allergy dermatitis, where they get bit by a single flea can trigger it, to things like pollens and molds. And so if your veterinarian is not in a position to do allergy testing, you may want to ask them to refer you to a veterinary dermatologist so that this can be looked into. There's no need for your cat to be on steroids the rest of its life. I mean, I think a short-term round every once in a while is okay. But for long-term management, there's other things that you can do, whether it's immunologic therapy with allergy shots or using other drugs like cyclosporine, which blocks the immune response and helps pets with allergies as well. So I think it's time to go back to your veterinarian and say, hey, I need a diet that's going to help my cat, or, you know, what else can we do for testing?
Well, and Sandy, it seems like an 8-pound weight gain in a cat is awfully significant.
That's like probably double the weight that he should be. And and that's one of the issues with some of these, I call them rocket fuel in a bag type foods. The new foods that are out that are these grain-free diets tend to be really high in fat and really high in calories. And so that would be another thing that your veterinarian could help you with, is figuring out how many calories your pet needs a day to maintain the perfect weight. Because the last thing you need is an overweight cat with allergies that's also diabetic. And that's where your cat's heading.
Thanks for that call, Jennifer. And let's go to Mackenzie in Madison next. Hi, Mackenzie.
Hi. I have kind of two questions. My cat is overweight. He's 18 pounds right now. And a vet said he needs to get down to 14. How much food should we be giving him to get him down to that weight? He's relatively active. He's an adult cat, probably between 4 and 5.
Yeah, there's actually, I usually sit down and I don't have my little calculator or my formula that I use, but there's a formula that you can plug in their ideal weight, and it you crunch some numbers and it comes up with the number of how many calories a day they need. Just from my memory, I would have to say that a cat that needs to weigh 14 pounds probably needs about 220 calories a day. And so then it comes down to looking at how many calories are in the food that you're feeding. When you're, you know, choosing a diet, it is not the law to put the calorie amount on the package. So you may have to do a little bit of online search or calling the company to find out, you know, just how many calories are in a cup. Some of the diets that we have out there are 500 plus calories a cup, and there are many, most of the diets you're going to find are probably 350 to 400 calories. So yeah, then you have to do the math. You find out how many calories per cup, how many calories your cat needs, do the math and figure it out. So if you're feeding a diet that's 400 calories a cup, your cat would need about half a cup of food a day. And that's what you segue into. The other thing to be looking at too is the protein content of the food. For weight loss, cats seem to do better on a low carbohydrate, low fat, high protein food. We call it the Catkins diet, and they do very well on that. It seems to boost their metabolism, help them maintain lean body tissue, and help them burn more fat. So it's a really good diet for them, but getting that is probably going to mean going to your veterinarian, because that's, again, a therapeutic diet that you could probably only get through your veterinarian.
Okay. And my second question is, since we got him, we've noticed that he likes to lick plastic bags.
Oh, I had a cat that did that too. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we just keep them away from him. We didn't know if there was any sort of medical issue why he would be licking plastic bags, or if it's just a fixation. Like, we have to physically remove him from the plastic and shut doors.
Oh, yeah. And I had a cat that's all, I mean, if you came in with like the plastic grocery sacks, that kind of like real thin plastic, oh my goodness, he would know that I came in with the bag and be running to try to lick it. And so we had to keep them in a, you know, locked door. And it convinced me to start using, you know, the reusable shopping bags very early before they became the fad. So, yeah, it's just one of those things that we hear very frequently in cats. I have no idea whether it's your skin oils or oils on the plastic or the mouthfeel, but there's no medical basis for it. It's just something that it's a little pica that your cat likes.
Thanks for that call, Mackenzie. And Beth in Green Bay, we're on to you. Hi, Beth.
Hi. I just have a quick question. I have been discussing with my sister. She's getting a puppy, and she heard or read somewhere that it's best to wait for the dog to go through one heat cycle before spaying, just because they become more mature.
Yeah.
And that's a puppy like.
Yeah, no, it's probably not going to change the pet's personality at all. The big issue with early age spay neutering in spaying in female dogs is the increased risk of urinary incontinence. And by early age, I mean like prior to 3-4 months of age. But if you do it at the standard age of 6 months or so, then, you know, you've pretty well, I mean, it still can happen, but it's not going to be at an increased risk of having a dog that's going to be leaking urine and needing probably lifetime medication. So I would not let them have a heat cycle. One, it's going to increase the risk of unwanted pregnancies. It may cause them to have, even though it's minimal, it may increase the risk of breast cancer down the road. There's very little reason to let them have a heat cycle. And especially behaviorally, it's not going to make any change at all.
Thanks, Beth. And now let's go to Monica in Eau Claire. Hi, Monica.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
My question, we have an English setter. He's approximately 7 years old. He's our hunting dog. And we're starting to worry that he may be completely blind or going blind. He is running into things. He seems to just do some really stupid things. He fell off the dock into the water this weekend.
Oh, my goodness.
No, he loves to swim, not a big deal. But then he went to jump in the back of the car, and the door wasn't even open to the car. But because my husband had called him and was standing by the car, he just...
Oh, well, it sure sounds like he's visually impaired. And dogs are amazing at masking this for the most part. It doesn't sound like your dog is, but I had a dog in the other day that ended up going acutely blind. He had a condition called SARD, sudden acquired retinal degeneration, where it's just like overnight they can lose their vision. And the big symptom for him was he just didn't want to move, and he was scared, and he just kind of laid laid there and didn't want to move. But other dogs, they if their blindness occurs very slowly, where they can become adjusted to it, they use their other senses, and we'll see them walking and barely have their nose touch something, and they know that they have to turn. They use their sense of smell. Their hearing is better, and they, you know, they get along. And as long as you're not rearranging the furniture or, you know, leaving things on the floor that weren't there before, you know, most owners don't even realize that their dog is blind when they're in an environment where it's very controlled. In this case, it sounds like your dog spends a lot of time outside. You're going to need to be his eyes. First, get him into your veterinarian to make sure that there isn't a medical reason for his vision loss. Make sure he's not hypertensive, that he doesn't have glaucoma or cataracts or something that could potentially be fixed. Cataracts are something that we can do surgery on. And if, you know, that may improve his, it definitely would improve his quality of life if that's what's causing his vision loss. But you need to probably have him on a leash. Be a seeing eye person for him, so that it keeps him out of trouble. That's got to be so frightening. Imagine falling off a dock and not knowing which way's shore, because you can't see. That's just got to be a bad, bad situation to be in. So, you know, leashes, and you be with him all the time.
Thanks, Monica. Good luck with that. We're talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk today of the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine here on The Larry Miller Show. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry today. And if you'd like to join in the conversation, you can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page. And Barb did exactly that, Sandy. She had a question. Two of our dogs tested for anaplasmosis when their heartworm checks were done, she said. Is this something they'll test positive for the rest of their lives? They've never showed any symptoms. What, if anything, should we watch for?
We see a lot of anaplasmosis in this area. Anaplasma is spread by the deer tick. It's another tick-borne disease, and we see it sometimes as a co-infection with Lyme disease. Just because they test positive doesn't mean that they're going to develop clinical signs. And it can be a silent infection, which was what most dogs have. But probably the big things that we'll see is an effect on the white blood cell or the platelet production, I should say. And so when we have a dog that's been diagnosed that's anaplasma positive, I usually will run blood cell counts to make sure that they're not showing any issues with the bone marrow being affected. If that's normal, then just watching for lameness, fever, lethargy, anything where your dog just very vague symptoms. I have had some dogs that be positive for a couple of years in a row, and then all of a sudden they revert to a negative status. So I think it's something that, you know, it's just going to be a wait and see what happens. But be watching, especially if you're going to be doing any surgery on your dogs, you know, checking that platelet count prior to having anything done if they're positive, because you don't want them to be bleeding excessively during surgery.
Elaine in New Glarus is next. Hi, Elaine.
Hello?
Hi. Go ahead.
Hi. Oh, this is Elaine Albright, and I'm calling about my 13-month-old St. Bernard, and you did have an earlier caller that had St. Bernard questions. Mine is about Maggie May, and she was the runt of 9 puppies. And she was raised by people that tried to raise these puppies as cheap as they could. So they force-fed her with bread, because when I took her home, it took her 3 days before she could have a bowel movement. Mm. I was wondering, she's 13 months old, and would this make her have intestinal problems, because they dead force feed her kind of thing?
Is she having any problems now?
Well, she will go through, there's times before we found the food we got her on now, which is Beneful, and then we mix some wet food with that, just anything to kind of give it some good flavor, because she'll go through a bag of food and then she's tired of it. Mm-hmm. And she needs something else. So I don't know. What we feed her is Beneful, and then I mix in this stuff that tastes like meat with it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that what happened with her as a baby, in, you know, for long-term health risks, could have affected her growth potential, if she was on a, you know, non-well-balanced, you know, puppy formula, then that potentially could be a problem for her down the road if her joints didn't form correctly or, you know, that would be the big thing. But right now, if she's eating and healthy and happy, I kind of, that's just maybe a blip in the past that I'm glad she's in your hands now so that she's getting proper care. But I probably accept the orthopedic issues. I can't see any long-term issues with anything like that.
Thanks for that call, Elaine. And let's go on to Rita in Madison. Hi, Rita.
Hi. Thank you for my call. I have a question about our kitty. She's about 5 years old now, and the back of her ears, she's lost her fur. We started to notice this in January, and then took her in for her regular checkup in February, and the vet took some hair off of it with a little tweezers and cultured it because he thought it was a fungus. And then he gave us I think it was called Tresiderm or something like Tesoderm.
Mm-hmm. Yep, Tresiderm. That's an eardrop that were you using it on the ear itself or down in the ear canal?
On the back of the ear.
Okay. Okay.
Her ear canal is fine. It's
okay.
Just only on the back and one ear was pretty much all hairless, and then there was a little bit on the other ear starting. And so I did that, and the culture came back negative, and I sort of stopped putting it on because it just didn't seem like it was doing anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I, you know, he thought, oh, it could be a flea or something, but...
Well, yeah, I'm thinking allergies. Do you see her scratching at her ears?
Not really.
Okay, and there's no scabs?
Now that she's been outside a little more, maybe when we're home, we'll let her out. She is kind of scratching a little more in general, but...
Well, make sure since allergies are on the radar, make sure you're using a good flea control product to keep fleas off of her. Many good ones out there. Be careful about buying over-the-counter products to make sure that you're using one that's appropriate for your cat. So again, this would be something to talk to your veterinarian about to make sure you got the right product at the right weight. Because, like I said, fleas are common, and a flea allergy problem, they could be bit on their end of their tail, and yet cats typically will scratch their head. I know it's weird, but that's what happens. They get allergic to the flea saliva, and it's in their system, and that tends to be the part of their body that they get the most reaction in. You know, if the ear canals were clean, they didn't find any ringworm, didn't culture positive for ringworm, there's no other external parasites or anything there, then I think your next step would be, if you feel that it's affecting your cat's quality of life, having her allergy tested. And start looking into that, just like we talked about with the other caller.
Thanks for that call, Rita. Sandy, we had an email from Lori. She says, my boyfriend and I are looking at getting a bull terrier. He really wants a male. I have no preference. We were wondering the pros and cons of a male versus a female. The dog will be fixed and not bred.
Probably no difference at all. Okay, very little difference at all personality-wise. Males tend to be bigger. And so if you want a little bit bigger, more muscular dog, then getting a male would, even if it's neutered, would send you down the right path. But really makes no difference. You have to look at just the personality of the dog when you go and investigate the litter to find one that matches what you want in a dog.
And bull terriers, often people have a lot of preconceptions about them.
Well, that's like the Spuds McKenzie dog. And they are a handful. Okay. They are very active, muscular dogs, can be very bullheaded. Okay. But I love them to death. I think that if they're in the right hands with the right training, they can make wonderful family pets.
Sandy Sawchuk has been our guest today. She's clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. As always, Sandy, more callers, more emails, and more questions than we could ever hope to get to in 90 minutes. But you'll be back on June 14th, I believe it is.
I believe so.
Yeah, we've got you on a regular schedule, second Tuesday of the month. So hopefully we can talk about some of those things then. So thanks, as always, for coming in. Tomorrow, Larry will be back. And at 11, he'll be talking with staffers of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. information about some current opportunities to both view our state's wetlands and also some proposed legislation that could help protect those natural resources. Then tomorrow at 11:45, he's going to welcome back fishing guide and outdoor writer Gary Engberg to talk about fishing. If you're a fisher person, we'd love to hear from you, especially how you got involved with it as a young person. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Today, I've been sitting in for Larry Mueller. We hope you'll go to our Facebook page. If you click like on the Facebook page, you will get a daily update on upcoming topics, so you make sure that you know what's coming up. And we always love to hear from you. You can post questions or comments and let us know what you're thinking. Do stay tuned to the Ideas Network today, Chapter a Day coming up after the Larry Mueller Show, and then lots of great things coming up after that. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Thanks for listening.